This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, deep roasting and blending coffee beans since 1966, Pete's.com or 800-999-2132.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Gelda.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, beginning July 1st, one of the biggest voter registration drives in the nation is set to launch to increase Latino voter registration and citizenship ahead of the November elections.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,525 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports 43,140 civilians have been reportedly killed by the military intervention in Iraq. The website, InformationClearinghouse.info, reports the true civilian casualty rate is as high as 250,000 dead.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, June 29th, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra, of course, with my dog Cosmo. A memorial service was held today in Portland for Army Specialist Robert Jones, who was killed in Iraq. More than 100 Patriot Guard riders on motorcycles led a burial procession from the New Hope Community Church in Clackamas to the Willamette National Cemetery. The 22-year-old soldier was from Milwaukee and was a 2002 graduate of Rex Putnam High School. Governor Ted Kulongoski cut short a trip to Japan and South Korea to attend this funeral. Jones was killed in combat in Ramadi, west of Baghdad, when an explosive device detonated near his vehicle. He was the 59th soldier with ties to Oregon to die in the current conflicts in Iraq and the Middle East. The Oregonian reported this was Jones' second tour of duty in Iraq, and he was the only one supposed to be there for a month to give other soldiers a break. Another memorial service is planned for Private First Class Thomas Lowell Tucker of Madras and for this Saturday.
Oregon farmers say the U.S. government's decision to place National Guard troops along the Mexican border is contributing to a shortage of workers to pick ripe fruit. Terry Drasdorf said farm workers should be harvesting 25 tons of fruit per day from his Polk County cherry orchard. Instead, he can only hire enough migrant workers to pick 6 tons. Though Drasdorf and several other growers blame the government's attempt to limit the flow of illegal immigrants, experts in migrant labor say the number of migrant workers passing through the Willamette Valley has been dropping for years. Daniel Quinones, a farm worker representative for the Oregon Employment Department, said there's simply less work for them as more farmers switch to machine-harvested crops such as grass seed. Quinones, however, added that the controversy over illegal immigration might be discouraging some workers from following the crop harvest on the West Coast.
The Bush administration has been unable to muster even half of the 2,500 National Guardsmen it planned to have on the Mexican border by the end of June. And as of today, the next to last day of the month, fewer than 1,000 troops are in place, according to military officials in the 4 border states that include Texas, California, New Mexico, and Arizona. President Bush's plan called for all 50 states to send these troops, but only 10 of these states, including the 4 border states, have signed commitments. And that's because some state officials have argued that they can't free up guardsmen because of flooding or anticipated hurricanes. National Guard officials also said the number of troops will fluctuate from week to week over the course of the next over the two-year mission. The Bush administration is essentially fortifying the U.S.-Mexican border with razor wire and concrete barriers.
Beginning July 1st, over 50 cities nationwide will be participating in a campaign to increase Latino voter registration and citizenship ahead of the November elections. Today in Salem, Oregon's Immigrants' Rights Coalition, CAUSA, announced its plans for a series of forums, workshops, and voter registration drives this summer. CAUSA also presented a report finding that Oregon's 107,000 potential new immigrant voters could swing the next election. KBOO's Jacob Fenston spoke with CAUSA's Erica Steinbauer following the group's press conference. Steinbauer outlines the contents of the report.
Overall, the report documents that in the United States, there's 14.25 million immigrants and children of immigrants who are a potential voting bloc. And it also outlines the 11 presidential swing states where the number of immigrant voters is greater than the vote differential between Bush and Kerry in 2004.
So in the report, what were the numbers for Oregon?
The Oregon numbers also speak strongly for themselves because the combined number of immigrants in Oregon who are eligible to naturalize, combined with the unregistered U.S.-born children of immigrants, and then the U.S.-born children of immigrants who will be eligible to vote in 2008, is over 107,000, which is well over the Bush-Kerry margin in 2004.
And what are some of the activities or things that you're doing this summer to promote civic participation?
CAUSA is doing a statewide tour that has a couple different goals. The first one is to inform the immigrant community about the legislative process and also about contents in the recently passed Senate immigration process, because many immigrant community members have questions about what's in the bill and if it's passed yet and how that would impact them. And then in those workshops, we're also doing some voter registration training and encouraging people, even if they aren't citizens, to refer their family members or friends who are U.S. citizens to us so we can register them to vote. And then we're partnering with several organizations in the Salem area to do a voter registration drive in this area. There's been talk of doing more outreach over MySpace and doing text messages using some of the technology that was used during the marches to mobilize youth, to continue to use that to promote voter registration.
That was Erica Steinbauer of CAUSA speaking with KBOO's Jacob Fenston.
Because of Enron's fraudulent dealings, the Snohomish County Public Utility District in Washington State will not have to pay a $122 million contract termination fee, federal energy regulators ruled yesterday. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission decided under an amendment to the 2005 Energy Policy Act that Enron could not hold the PUD to a nine-year contract that it signed in 2001 with the energy trader. The decision was included in a settlement that sends about $10 million to utilities and government entities in the Northwest, which includes the PUD, the Port of Seattle, and the Grays Harbor PUD. Tacoma Power settled its dispute with Enron on Tuesday for $3.3 million. The Snohomish PUD will proceed in court with damage claims against Enron totaling about $100 million. How much the PUD might receive likely will be settled in bankruptcy court.
And now another edition of Our Backyard, KBOO's homegrown environmental activist report from Edison Carter.
Welcome to Our Backyard, locally produced reports and commentary about issues affecting food, water, and air quality in our backyard. This edition, a story about biotechnology and the genetically engineered crops that result from this scientific method. Are these genetically modified crops safe for human consumption, and what exactly is adventitious presence? Well, the answer to the safety question seems to depend upon whom you ask. While some limited testing has been conducted, none has been conclusive, and the term adventitious presence refers to the unintentional and incidental commingling of trace amounts of one type of seed, grain, or food product with another. Adventitious presence is an unavoidable reality of plant biology, seed production, and the distribution of commodity crops. And therefore, at least one thing is perfectly clear. Even if genetically engineered crops are safe for humans, they may turn out to be deadly for organic farmers. Biotechnology modifies the structure, physiology, or genetic constitution of biological organisms and is referred to as genetic engineering, or GE. Today, it's estimated that at least 70% of processed foods on grocery store shelves contain ingredients and oils from biotech crops. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, in the U.S. in 2005, 87% of soybeans, 79% of cotton, 60% of canola, and 62% of corn were biotech. In addition, genetically engineered flax, papaya, potatoes, radicchio, soybeans, squash, and sugar beet have all been approved for sale, although several of these have either been withdrawn by developers or not embraced by growers. And that's because, primarily, growers are reluctant to risk international markets that in many instances refuse to accept biotech products. An example, genetically modified papayas grown in Hawaii. Papaya has been grown in tropical regions for centuries, and the Hawaii export market was flourishing until the introduction of genetically engineered papaya in 1998. Countries importing papaya from Hawaii, including the EU, Japan, and China, have an aversion to GE crops and foods. Doors started closing on Hawaii's exports, and prices went into freefall. And organic and even conventional farmers have suffered losses since it's difficult to guarantee the GE-free status of their crops due to the contamination from neighboring commercial GE farms, and evidence of that contamination has already been verified. Organic Consumer calls the gene-altered papayas in Hawaii an economic and environmental disaster. And now, the USDA has announced that they are accepting public comments regarding the commercial approval of a genetically engineered plum variety currently designated as C5, but something critics have labeled the Frankenplum. Not only would the approval of C5 be the first commercially released GE tree variety in the United States, but also the first GE fruit approved for human consumption. Approval of C5 will pave the way for more GE food and tree varieties, as well as guarantee the widespread genetic contamination of conventional and organic stone fruit varieties, including plums, peaches, cherries, and apricots. And just last month, researchers at Oregon State University published their discovery of the genetic controls that cause trees to stop growing and go dormant in the fall, as well as the mechanism that causes them to begin flowering and produce seeds. The OSU press release says, "This discovery represents a significant fundamental advance in explaining the annual growth cycles and reproduction of trees. By knowing the genes that control these processes, it should be possible to genetically engineer trees that flower and reproduce more quickly. This may open the door to important advances in intensive forestry and fruit tree improvement." Yes, but at what cost to the environment and to organic fruit growers? And remember that adventitious presence thing? According to the Center for Food Safety, contamination of the food supply by experimental genetically engineered crops will be deemed acceptable under a new policy expected to be released soon by the Food and Drug Administration. As the biotechnology industry conducts more open-air field tests of increasingly complex and risky genetic transformations in common foods, contamination of the food supply through pollen drift and other avenues becomes more likely. It's easy to see how increasingly difficult it will become for organic growers to maintain the integrity of their crops and assure those of us who prefer organics that they haven't been inadvertently contaminated. Organic growers need our help. You can go to organicconsumers.org and sign the online petition that will be sent to the USDA. We've got until July 17th. And continue to support local organic growers and farmers markets. They need us now more than ever. In the meantime, keep listening to KBOO News and Public Affairs and stay informed. After all, this is our backyard.
Nearly 900 felons have been removed from the Washington State's voting rolls, officials said today. Secretary of State Sam Reid announced today that his office purged 848 people who are either still in prison or under the supervision of the state. Those who only owe fines were not removed from the database, these officials said. But the effort was the result of the first statewide screening for illegally registered felons since the new statewide voter database was launched in January. In May, Reid announced that about 55,000 voter registrations were scrubbed after investigators found duplicate entries and dead voters on the rolls. The state had to postpone efforts to remove the felons after a King County's judge's March ruling that released felons can't be kept from voting simply because of unpaid fines and fees. The state has appealed that ruling, though, and made arguments before the state Supreme Court on Tuesday. The High Court could issue a ruling later this year.
The city of Berkeley, California, will let voters decide whether to call for the impeachment of President George Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. The city council voted last night to put an advisory measure on the November ballot calling for the impeachment. The measure says the administration violated the Constitution with illegal domestic spying, justified the Iraq war with fraudulent claims, and illegally tortured citizens. The move is largely symbolic.
Senate Commerce Committee endorsed a sweeping overhaul of telecommunications laws yesterday. However, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden used an obscure parliamentary procedure to freeze the new laws until network neutrality provisions could be put in place. In a far-reaching vote, though, just before the 22 senators on the committee, which endorsed television reforms and dozens of other changes, but they deadlocked 11-11 and thus rejected an amendment requiring the Federal Communications Commission to prevent phone and cable companies from charging special fees for the delivery of video content. It wasn't immediately clear, though, when the measure will come to the Senate floor because of Wyden's move.
Arkansas cannot ban homosexuals from becoming foster parents because there is no link between their sexual orientation and a child's well-being, the state's high court ruled Thursday. The court agreed with the lower court judge that the state's child welfare board had improperly tried to regulate public morality. The ban also violated the separation of powers doctrine, the justices said. The board instituted the ban in 1999, saying children should be in traditional two-parent homes because they would be more likely to thrive. Four residents sued, claiming discrimination and privacy violations against homosexuals who otherwise qualified as foster parents. The justices agreed Thursday, saying the ban was an attempt to legislate for the General Assembly with respect to public morality.
The California Supreme Court agreed yesterday that two teenagers who were expelled from a Lutheran high school in Riverside County because of an alleged lesbian relationship can sue the school. The state high court refused to consider California Lutheran High School's appeal of a lower court's ruling that the 16-year-old girls' civil rights may have been violated when they were kicked out in September. In declining Wednesday to take up the case, justices cleared the student's lawsuit to go to trial. The suit seeks the pair's readmission, unspecified damages, and an injunction barring the school from excluding gays and lesbians.
Roger Stilwell, the desk officer for the Mariana Islands at the U.S. Department of the Interior, is expected to plead guilty to a misdemeanor count of false certification, his attorney confirmed yesterday. Stilwell dealt closely with disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Department of Justice officials charged Stilwell with filing a financial disclosure report for fiscal year 2003 that, quote, falsely certified that he did not receive reportable gifts from a prohibited source. The charges against Stilwell are the first connected to the Abramoff scandal to touch the Interior Department, and they mark an expansion of the government's ongoing investigation into public corruption involving the convicted lobbyist. So far, five people, Abramoff and former associates Michael Scanlon, Tony Rudy, Neil Volz, and Adam Kaiden, have pleaded guilty. Earlier this month, David Savavian, the former top procurement officer for the Office of Management and Budget, was convicted of multiple charges stemming from his dealings with Abramoff.
A mid-level manager at the Homeland Security Department was charged with immigration documents fraud today. Robert T. Schofield, a federal immigration officer since 1976, appeared in U.S. District Court in Alexandria, Virginia, and awaits a bond hearing tomorrow. An alleged co-conspirator, conspirator Kim Yi, a Chinese citizen, also was charged with immigration document fraud. Schofield oversees immigration applications under review at the department's district office in Fairfax, and court papers say he has been the subject of numerous allegations of bribery involving Asian immigration applicants going back some 10 years. The court papers also cite some other evidence of misconduct in the past, which includes $36,000 in unauthorized purchases on Schofield's government-issued credit card. And there's evidence that at least 23 people obtained naturalization certificates from Schofield to which they were not entitled, according to these papers. Schofield and Yi each could face some 10 years in prison if they're convicted.
The New York Times reports two Senate Democrats yesterday criticized a White House plan to cut money intended for food stamps, student loans, and farmers. That's to pay for credit monitoring for veterans whose personal and financial data was stolen last month. Personal data on about 17.5 million veterans, including their birth dates and Social Security numbers, was stolen last month from the home of an analyst for the Department of Veterans Affairs. The analyst was not authorized to take the data home, but had been doing so for several years. The VA offered to pay for a year of free credit monitoring for the veterans, which it said would cost about $160 million. Last week, the department said it would cover most of that cost by taking money from accounts that pay health and other benefits for veterans. The White House has said it did not want to raise new money to pay for the program, but rather to take money from other areas of the White House budget.
In Nebraska, a hacker broke into the state's child support computer system and may have obtained the names, Social Security numbers, and other information of 300,000 people and 9,000 employers, the state treasurer announced today. The hacker got into a backup computer server Wednesday morning for about 40 minutes and then launched a virus, which state treasurer Ron Ross said was immediately removed. Ross said the attack appeared to be routed through Australia from Asia. The State Patrol launched a computer forensic investigation.
In a blow to the Bush administration, the Supreme Court rejected the use of military tribunals to try Guantanamo Bay detainee Salim Ahmed Hamdan. The victors in the case say the decision is an essential use of checks and balances, while the dissenters say the court is overstepping the president's war powers. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
In Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, the court ruled 5-3 that military tribunals to try detainees are illegal. The decision will have no impact on the existence of Guantanamo Bay, the military detention center holding about 450 detainees, but it does mean that detainees charged with crimes will be tried with the same rights as an American citizen. Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift of the Navy, one of Hamdan's defense attorneys.
All we have wanted is a fair trial, and we thank the Supreme Court for ensuring that Mr. Hamdan will get one.
Salim Ahmed Hamdan is known as Osama bin Laden's former driver and Guantanamo Bay detainee. He contested that he should be tried in a civilian court rather than a military tribunal set up by the president. The majority opinion, written by Justice John Paul Stevens, said that the rules specified for Hamdan's military trial were illegal. Hamdan would have had to forfeit many of his rights, including the right to be present at his trial. Stevens wrote the military tribunal created to try Hamdan did not adhere to the Geneva Convention of 1949 and that Congress never authorized the tribunal. The dissenting opinion, written by Justice Scalia, supports presidential power. The opinion said the court overstepped its authority in an issue they have no expertise, and that issue is war. Richard Samp, one attorney for the government, reiterated that opinion.
The decision today is a travesty in terms of the way that the court has decided to establish itself as a super military authority and to second guess the views not only of the executive branch but also of Congress.
The dissenting opinion also said the case will open the courts to a flood of Gitmo detainee cases. Justice Clarence Thomas read a second dissenting opinion. He has never read a dissent in his 15 years on the court, but felt this decision was too unfortunate not to do so. Two current options for trials do exist, the federal court system or court martials. Court martials are used for U.S. military personnel and criminals of war and assures constitutional rights of the alleged. But the president would like to keep the military tribunals open.
We will conform to the Supreme Court. We will analyze the decision. To the extent that the Congress has given any latitude to develop a way forward using military tribunals, we will work with them.
Richard Samp, attorney for the government, says new legislation to legalize the military tribunals is a possible solution.
It is a relatively narrow procedural decision which allows the government to go forward with military tribunals if it wants to slightly amend its rules.
Neil Katia, an attorney for Hamdan, interpreted that option as undesirable.
It is up to Congress, of course, but what I think the court said today is that our fundamental values are at stake, and I think issued a cautionary note to those who would rush in and legislate, just as President Bush rushed in to create these military commissions.
Civil rights groups praised the court's decision. Meanwhile, activists outside the courthouse protested the detention center. Art Laffin is with the Catholic group Dorothy Day.
And unfortunately, it's 4 years too late. And so many people have suffered horrific experiences undergoing torture and other mistreatment at Guantanamo. And then there have been three suicides there. And this would be cause enough to say that this place should be closed up.
Chief Justice John Roberts abstained from today's ruling. He was part of the lower court decision which upheld military tribunals. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
Earlier this week, KBU spoke with Lieutenant Aaron Ouattara, now being held by U.S. military authorities for refusing to deploy in Iraq with his striker brigade. And last night, we spoke with Ann Wright, called the Commandante of Camp Casey, on growing anti-war sentiment within the U.S. military. Then tonight, we hear from Monica Benderman, a wife of Sergeant Kevin Benderman, an active duty soldier serving 15 months in confinement at Fort Lewis, Washington, for requesting conscientious objector status. KBOO reporter Miriam Widman spoke with Monica Benderman earlier this week.
Monica Benderman said her husband was then assigned to a unit that was not going to be redeployed to Iraq. But 2 weeks later, Army officials filed a court-martial against him. Today, Kevin Benderman sits in a military prison in Fort Lewis, Washington, convicted of missing movement. As it stands now, he faces a cut in pay, a reduction in rank, and a dishonorable discharge when his sentence is up in October. His wife and others are trying to get the sentence overturned, based in part on mistakes they said the military made.
They admitted in the court-martial that they didn't know the regulation for conscientious objection. If they had known, they would have taken steps to correct their actions. So they admitted that they mishandled it. But they didn't do anything to fix it.
On top of that, Mrs. Benderman notes her husband's conscientious objector application was denied in record time.
So they moved very quickly, and something that normally takes a year to a year and a half for a conscientious objector application took 3 months.
Monica Benderman said the board reviewing conscientious objector applications in Washington, D.C., only had Kevin's application for 14 days before they rejected it.
Now, how could they consider everything that was presented and think deeply about a soldier's conscious choice exactly 2 weeks later?
Since Kevin originally enlisted nearly two decades ago and then re-enlisted, some might not understand why he is now filing for conscientious objector status. Monica explains why her husband initially joined the military.
Kevin joined because he felt that a strong military, one that adheres to discipline, one that adheres to order, one that respects the work that the soldiers do, and where the command respects the soldiers that serve with them, that acts as a deterrent against war. It's not, you know, it's not a unit that can be used to just go at will and create aggression. But by having a strong military, it keeps people at bay. That's a big part of our security. And that's how Kevin saw it. By being ready, you know, he hoped that they would never have to be in war, that it would be enough of a deterrent by knowing the strength that the military was.
He reenlisted because he had only served part of the original 8-year commitment and felt he hadn't lived up to his agreement. What he saw in Iraq when he was deployed sickened him, and he decided to obtain a conscientious objector status. Next month, the Bendermans face a hearing on Kevin's appeal, but Monica believes that will be delayed as the couple tries to obtain a civilian attorney, which she says is very important.
By bringing a civilian attorney in, now you've got civilian oversight. You know, because you've got somebody that the military can't control, that is going to ask questions, that is going to assert their civilian oversight on the military and help make it more just.
But she notes that costs money, and that's something most military families don't have. In addition to fighting her husband's court-martial and rejected conscientious objection status, Mrs. Benderman is also working to raise awareness among the nation's young people. Her own son, who is 18, has written conscientious objector all over his selective service registration form, and she urges others considering such a status to do the same.
When people call and say, my son just turned 18, what should I do? What we recommend is that when they do get their selective service card, you have to send it back. Right across it, conscientious objector. It's really not going to do anything because there isn't a draft. They probably aren't even going to put it in the computer as that. But at least you know that you've done it, and somebody back there at the Selective Service Board will see it. At the same time, write a letter. Have your child do it. Have your child do it in their words. I will not participate in war, and these are the reasons why.
She suggests making multiple copies of the letter, signing it, and sealing it with the date sealed across the top. Keep one for your records, send one to an attorney, and others to trusted friends and clergy people.
So if there's ever a day when there is a draft that comes and they draw from the Selective Service Board, you got these letters that can come from 15 different people in a matter of 3 days and say, look, you know, here's the evidence that 5 years ago this is how my child thought.
To date, the Bendermans have received mainly positive responses and support. Monica notes that, as expected, the supervisors in Kevin's unit called him a coward when he tried to file the conscientious objector status. But the family has received much support. Unexpectedly, the bulk of it from overseas.
What surprises us is how great the response is from foreign countries, because it's overwhelmingly foreign countries that we hear from.
Not so much from Americans?
Not nearly as much, no. I would say it's 30% to 70%.
Wow. I mean, how does it make you feel? Are you disappointed in the United States?
Can't be disappointed in the United States. You have to be understanding that this is the place that our country has gotten to. How can you be disappointed? You know, a lot of it comes from the fact that, people just aren't educated to the history. You know, history is shut down, and we need to find a way to get people interested in the fact that this country has value, and it's not just sitting around a ho-hum, and it's not thinking globally. You know, I mean, you can go think about Poland, you can think about Darfur, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't because there are inhumane acts going on there. But the fact is, it's almost like so many people look away because they don't want to stop to think that this is what's really going on in their own country, too. And, so we'd really like to think that people would start taking notice to their country and what's happening here, because so many people in other countries can see it. You know, maybe it's too close to us, but so many other countries can see what's happening here. And a lot of people write to us and say, you know, when is America going to think about America? You know, I don't know. We ask the same question.
Just recently, Monica Benderman received 150 notes from school children who live in Canada. For KBU News, I'm Miriam Widman.
And that was KBU's Miriam Widman speaking with Monica Benderman. For more information on the Benderman case, go to www.bendermandefense.org.
Another suicide car bomb, this one at a funeral, has killed 4 people in Iraq. Police say the attacker blew himself up in a tent where mourners had gathered for a service for a Shiite soldier in the northern city of Kirkuk. Police say a police officer was among those killed, and 2 other officers were among 17 wounded. The latest violence adds to the drive-by shooting, roadside bomb, and ambush toll from earlier today. In addition to those who died today, 6 more bodies were found dumped around Iraq. It's 5:33, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Do you have one of those really good jobs in which your pay is automatically raised every single year by nearly $4,000? And the only way your pay hike can be withheld is if you choose not to accept it. You won't find these jobs in the Help Wanted ads, friends. You find them in Congress. Once again, our Congress critters have generously bestowed a pay hike on themselves, raising their total annual take to $168,500 apiece. These are the same people who have refused to raise America's poverty-level minimum wage for 10 years and who have shown no concern for the majority of American working families whose wages have not even kept up with the rising cost of living. This month, House members voted for the 8th year in a row to up their own pay. In a little game of political dodgeball, congressional leaders of both parties run an insider scam that makes their pay raises automatic, unless they magnanimously vote to block it. Guess what? They don't. For 8 straight years, these statesmen have grabbed the money and run. Speaking of running, both parties' leaders have cut a secret Save the Incumbents pact, agreeing that their candidates will not use the pay raise as an issue in the fall elections. And you thought there was no bipartisanship left on Capitol Hill. Members tried to dismiss the pay hikes as a trivial sum, merely enough to keep them ahead of inflation. Over the 8 years of steady raises, however, these cost-of-living adjustments, as Congress likes to call them, have added a total of $32,000 to their paychecks. That's more than the annual income of most Americans, and it further isolates our Congress critters from the harsh economic reality being faced today by the great majority of people they supposedly represent. This is Jim Hightower saying, shouldn't at least one party be campaigning to bring Congress down to earth, starting with ending this soft cushion of automatic pay raises?
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for Independent Native News following our newscast. Sad to say, it's Independent Native News' last broadcast tonight. At 6 p.m., hear a KBOO special preview of the very cool Waterfront Blues Festival hosted by the J.J. Johnson and the Swinging Reggae Bob. And that's all tonight from 6 to 11 p.m. Very cool. And the weather. Warm tonight in the Willamette Valleys. High today were in the mid-80s. It's climbing towards the hot 90s through the weekend with a few of those Oregon clouds. In the Columbia Gorge, hotter tomorrow, but then cooling down with highs topping out in the mid-80s through the week. You are, of course, listening to the handcrafted KBOO Evening News for Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and, of course, Hood River.
The Israeli army carried out a number of large-scale invasions and arrests throughout the West Bank and East Jerusalem last night. At least 87 Palestinians were arrested, most of them Hamas-affiliated legislators and government officials. The Palestinian government declared the arrests an open act of war, and an Israeli settler abducted Monday was found dead in Ramallah this morning. Syed Banura reports from Beit Sahur, Palestine.
Among the Palestinian officials arrested in the latest Israeli raid was the leader of the Legislative Council, as well as ministers, mayors, bureaucrats, and council members. Al-Mutawakkil Taha, the Palestinian Deputy Minister of Information.
These are not merely arrests. They are extrajudicial abductions carried out by the occupation forces to destroy the Palestinian political regime and to create a vacuum state. We condemn all of these illegal procedures. We totally reject all of the excuses and justifications by the occupation forces to arrest these people who were legitimately elected. They know that these people have nothing to do with any military action. It came under the pretext that no Palestinian is immune, which means that every Palestinian is targeted.
Tayyip Abdul Rahim is advisor to the Palestinian president.
This policy is an attempt to destroy the Palestinian political system in order to avoid dealing with the Palestinian partner for peace. We ask the Israeli government and the international community to release the Palestinian legislators and mayors.
The Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz reported that the list of arrestees was approved weeks ago by Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Early Thursday morning, the Israeli army found the body of an Israeli settler abducted on Monday after an arrested Palestinian fighter revealed the location of the body during interrogation. The Nasser Salah al-Din Brigade's armed wing of the Palestinian Popular Resistance Committees, PRC, claimed they killed the settler. The brigades had threatened on Tuesday that they would kill the captive settler if Israeli attacks continued. Israeli and international actors are warning Israel that escalating military attacks will result in the death of the soldier they are purportedly attempting to rescue. Uri Avniri, former Israeli parliament member.
If the Israeli army believes that it has reliable information and that it has a plan to rescue the man alive, they could try it, but it's a kind of roulette. playing with the life of people, and I hope this will not happen again. I'm afraid of a military escalation on both sides, in which many people will die on both sides, and a lot of damage will be done on both sides, and I do hope very much that this can be avoided.
Israeli Defense Minister Amir Peretz held a meeting with his military officials Thursday afternoon in which he approved further steps of the military operation Summer Rain in Gaza. Today afternoon, Israeli warplanes airdropped leaflets on southern Gaza calling on Palestinians to avoid fighting against Israeli security forces, not to wander around in areas in which the army was operating, and to comply with army instruction for the sake of their own safety. Similar flyers were scattered over northern Gaza Wednesday, warning residents that the army will invade the area soon and threatened a large-scale military assault. Raji Sorani with the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza.
We were suffering from a state of real social-economical suffocation. Now, adding to that, all these military attacks, I mean by air, by sea, and by artillery, on very daily basis, where Gaza is shelled by 100 to 300 shells every day, it's a real hard and tough situation. It's, I can say, unprecedented one. I mean, anywhere in Gaza, you can sit and you will hear either direct or indirect sound of these artillery shells.
Palestinian political analysts have challenged the timing of this Israeli escalation, which came just after a Palestinian National Unity government was agreed to on Monday after months of negotiations. This is Saed Banoura reporting from imemc.org for Free Speech Radio News in Beit Sahour, Palestine.
Haiti's fledgling democratically elected government could be jeopardized by that country's massive foreign debt. This is according to Haitian groups pushing for debt cancellation. Haiti's President René Préval was sworn in a month ago. He's that country's first democratically elected president since a U.S.-backed military junta ousted President Aristide in early 2004. Now, U.S. Representative Maxine Waters has added her voice to those calling for debt relief. She introduced a House resolution urging international financial institutions to cancel Haiti's debt. KBOO's Jacob Fenston has more on the story.
Debt relief is extremely important for Haiti because Haiti is a poor country that's really trying to survive.
That's Congresswoman Maxine Waters, a Democrat from Los Angeles.
They cannot afford to pay off any debt. They need every dime they can get for just basic health care and education and potable water, and it would be just unconscionable to have them saddled with the worry of having to try and pay off debt in the face of the tremendous problems that they have in just trying to keep the country going.
The resolution Waters introduced would urge the World Bank and the IMF to immediately cancel Haiti's $1.4 billion in debt.
The resolution also urges the Secretary of the Treasury to use his voice and vote to influence and influence of the United States within these institutions. You know, we carry a big stick in these financial institutions. And we are co-sponsored by a bipartisan group of members, the 11 original co-sponsors, and now we have a dozen more co-sponsors that I'm adding today.
Congresswoman Waters says other important legislators have shown interest in the resolution and thinks it has a good chance of passing. Brian Kincannon is director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, one of the groups fighting for that country's debt relief.
Haiti's debt is both odious and onerous.
Kincannon says Haiti's debt is odious because nearly half of it was accrued by cruel dictators. Most notorious of these was Jean-Claude Baby Duck Duvalier.
He was basically stealing money hand over foot. He stole over $500 million. Some estimates are close to $1 billion that he stole. And that was money that the international community kept giving to Baby Doc because it was buying his friendship. It was not buying anything for the Haitian people, except that now they have the obligation to pay that money back.
Kincannon says the debt is onerous because Haiti does not have the ability to pay back the money.
Requiring it to do so means requiring children to die of preventable diseases. It requires keeping the country with the highest illiteracy rate in the hemisphere illiterate. It means having no potable water, so again, more children dying of waterborne diseases that they wouldn't get in another country, and all sorts of horrors inflicted on the Haitian people who have already suffered enough.
A donors' conference in July will seek new loans and aid to the country, the poorest in the Western Hemisphere. But Kincannon worries that money may only come on conditions unacceptable to the new government, such as cuts to public spending on health care and clean water. During President Aristide's government, the United States blocked hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to Haiti because Aristide refused to follow economic policies imposed by the U.S. Now, says Congresswoman Maxine Waters, it's time for the U.S. to lend Haiti a hand.
You know, Haiti has gone through a lot, you know, aside from the political problems that they have had and the ouster of their democratically elected president. The people just need a helping hand, and that's what we're urging the United States to do more of.
I'm Jacob Fenston, KBOO News.
Mexican voters head to the polls this Sunday for what may well be the closest presidential election in that country in nearly 200 years. With the two leading candidates only a few percentage points apart and fears of potential fraud, the stakes are high in this weekend's vote. FSRN's Norman Stockwell reports from Mexico City.
Standing beneath the statue of Mexico's most popular president, Benito Juarez, whose bicentennial is being celebrated this year, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO as he is nicknamed, draws his audience along to the obvious parallels. Juarez is celebrated for his opposition to French imperial occupation in the 19th century. AMLO wants to renegotiate the agriculture portions of NAFTA, which has caused over 1.6 million family farms to shut down since 1994. Fears over a potential trade war with Mexico is just one thing that has the U.S. nervous. A recently revealed secret military report states that Mexico is endangering oil production by not allowing enough, quote, foreign investment, a position strongly maintained by the PRD.
There has been this great swing of the pendulum in Latin America.
John Ross, longtime political observer and journalist based in Mexico City.
Neoliberalism failed, and Lula got elected, and Kirchner got elected, and Evo got elected, and Chavez got elected, and Tabaré Vázquez got elected. And the next guy to get elected on this in this scenario is López Obrador. He represents what they represent, although indeed, he may not turn out to represent that at all. But within the U.S. views, that's what he represents, no? And so it's very crucial for the U.S. to win, that López Obrador doesn't win this election, that Calderón wins this election.
A self-described left candidate, López Obrador, and his Alliance for the Good of All coalition, made up mostly of the Democratic Left PRD party, is leading by 2 or 3 percentage points in just about every poll. His chief opponent, Felipe Calderón of the National Action Party, or PAN, is fighting hard to retain the government his party only just wrested in 2000 from the hands of the PRI, or Institutional Revolutionary Party, which had held the presidency for over 70 years. Calderón, the successor to current President Vicente Fox, who is barred by the Constitution from seeking a second term, has his strongest support among Mexico's business classes. But with Mexico's shrinking economic growth and the devastating effects of over 10 years of the North American Free Trade Agreement on Mexico's over 25% rural population, Calderón has had a difficult time getting the ear of Mexico's poor and working class. Instead, he has used fear of social unrest and drug traffic to justify the hard hand of the state.
That they put themselves in charge of processing in a specialized way and with the full backing of society, the delinquents and narco-traffickers that are associated with powerful mafias. That they process them, judge them, convict them, and extradite them so that we can liberate places like Tijuana, like Nuevo Laredo, and like Acapulco of this cancer before it eats away at our society. Zero tolerance.
Roberto Madrazo, candidate for the PRI, has little to offer in terms of new ideas and mostly campaigns on the platform that the other parties have little or no experience in governing the country. Unfortunately, most of Mexico remembers all too well their experience under 7 decades of corrupt rule from his party and is not ready to revisit that recent past. Two other candidates, feminist Patricia Mercado of the Social Democratic Farmer Alternative Party and Roberto Campa of the New Alliance Party, a technocratic, economically conservative formation, create only small blips in the polling numbers. The PRD's López Obrador served as the mayor of Mexico City from 2000 to 2005 and is best known for his anti-poverty campaigns. It is his call for a new social compact that resonates most with the working people in this city.
Invito a todos
I invite everyone so that together we can pull our country forward, so that we can build a new accord, a new social pact, with the objective of moving our country forward and to take our people out of poverty and marginalization. We're going towards change on the road of harmony.
AMLO's campaign closing rally took place last night in the main square, or Zócalo, of Mexico City, where over 200,000 people gathered under banners reading, "Smile, we have already won." López Obrador looked beyond the elections and spoke of acting on his plans as president.
From next Monday on, I'm going to start calling forward representatives from companies, from churches, from civil society, representatives from indigenous and campesinos, professionals, intellectuals, to construct an accord, a new national pact with the main purpose of pushing our country forward, to place Mexico in the place it deserves among nations around the world, and overall, to take our people out of poverty and marginalization.
For Free Speech Radio News, reporting from Mexico City, this is Norman Stockwell.
A citizens' movement pushing intensely to remove the governor of the Mexican state of Oaxaca continues to gain momentum ahead of the presidential elections. Vladimir Flores reports from Oaxaca City.
Last night, more than 500,000 people marched over 7 miles through Oaxaca City calling for the resignation of the governor and his cabinet. Earlier this week, a delegation of public school teachers from Oaxaca traveled to Mexico City to deliver a petition containing what they say was close to 1 million signatures to the nation's Congress. The petition called on Congress to dissolve the government in Oaxaca and clear the path for an interim state government. The Senate has the power to declare a state government illegitimate in extreme cases of political instability. Meanwhile, organizations and citizens opposed to the state government have formed their own decision-making body called the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, known as APO by its initials in Spanish. As presidential elections near, many of the most influential organizations involved in the Oaxacan mobilizations are calling for the electorate to vote against the PRI party, which has ruled the state without interruption for over 75 years. Oaxaca, Mexico, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
Women in Kuwait voted in parliamentary elections Thursday for the first time. Balloting that also inspired surprisingly vocal calls for reform and criticism of the ruling family. The polls marked a new stage in the U.S. allies' tentative moves towards greater democracy, and not just because of the entry of women. The election brought unprecedented political activism in a country where the ruling family has strong influence over politics, with conservative Islamists joining liberals in demanding electoral reform and protesting corruption. Women who won the right to vote and run for office last year went to separate polling places from men, choosing among 249 candidates competing for 50 parliamentary seats. 27 candidates were women.
China will unveil a plan for a railway to Tibet this weekend, which is an engineering marvel, but a massive concern to Tibetan nationalists and environmentalists. Tibetans loyal to the exiled Dalai Lama and other critics say the $4.2 billion railway is part of a campaign by Beijing to crush Tibetan culture by encouraging an influx of Han Chinese, China's majority ethnic group. And environmental groups worry about the railway's impact on the Tibetan highlands. The railway plan features high-tech systems to stabilize tracks over permafrost and cabins enriched with oxygen to help riders cope with high altitudes. And that's the KBOO Evening News. You are listening to the handcrafted KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on translator K264 AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220 HR. And you can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscasts are Hannah Bierkamp and Lisa Loving. And our AP Wire editor is G.D. West. Tonight's audio editor is Josh Johnson. Special thanks to reporters Jacob Fenston, Miriam Woodman, and Edison Carter. Our engineer is, of course, Josh Johnson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra with Cosmo, the Radio Dog.
And I'm Liam Delta.